Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting email this week.
And I can't believe how many interesting emails I get every single week from people that are suffering from sexual addiction, love addiction. They are compulsive in their behaviors. They don't know what to do to make it right. And it can be very, very confusing. And let's face it, that is what the show is all about. It's to help people to figure out, do they have an issue? And if so, what do they do about it? Now, clearly, I talk to people that come in and they say, I've got a sex addiction. And they don't. They've got some issues around sex. They have some strong desires, but it's not compulsive, and it is not unmanageable. And so a lot of times I help them in a very different way than I would with somebody who has sex addiction. And I love being able to say, no, you don't really have a sex addiction or a love addiction. Now, you may be saying to yourself, what is love addiction? And tonight, we are going to be talking with an expert. Her name is Jessica Levis. And she's a marriage and family therapist who helps individual adult clients struggling with sex and love addiction. She also is a recovering sex and love addict. And she takes her life one day at a time. You know, she knows what it's like because she has had a disorder herself. So what is it? She's going to be talking about it. But I know that I did a conference for our local drug and alcohol hospital here, and they wanted to know more about love addiction. And there are lots and lots of definitions. There's lots and lots of focuses. But one of the things that I know to be true is that typically love addiction stems from two primary vulnerabilities. And those are low self-esteem and big and little T traumas. Now, you've heard us talk about those on the show. A big T trauma might be a rape. It might be a divorce. It might be going to war. A little T trauma might be neglect, abandonment, being chastised by a parent, being criticized. And so as you're listening to the show tonight, I want you to decide, what kind of traumas have you been through? Are they big traumas or little T traumas? Do you tend to minimize them and think, well, they couldn't possibly be part of my problem? Or do they feel huge and you sometimes wonder, will I ever get over the trauma I've had in my life? Now, truly, with any kind of addiction, the definition includes an obsessive-compulsive process. And it's used to relieve or medicate intolerable relationship realities. Now, what do I mean by that? You know, what's interesting, tonight in my group, one of the men very candidly said, after he participates in any kind of sexually addictive behavior, maybe it's compulsive masturbation, maybe it's pornography, maybe it's hooking up with prostitutes or with extramarital affairs, the one thing that he has to ask himself is, what is the payoff for this behavior? What's the payoff for participating in my addiction? And so that's the other thing I would ask you. What is the payoff after you've participated in the obsessive-compulsive process used to relieve or medicate? And that's what many of the men said. Some said, oh, I use it to medicate. Some said, oh, I use it as a release. Some say, oh, I use it to inflate my ego. Some say, oh, I use it to increase that sense of risk. But clearly, every man there said, it makes me feel horrible after the fact. I loathe myself as a result. And that is part of the compulsivity of this addiction. You know, you self-medicate with love or sex, and you get high on the rush of meeting or romancing or setting up the hookup or looking for the next best thing on porn. And then, after you've experienced that high, you get in touch with that impulse control that has been so gravely affected, and your lack of boundaries, your own internal navigation system that you have bypassed. And one of the men said tonight, you know, what I always say to myself after I participate in any behavior that's addictive, I say, not again. OMG, not again. I did it again. And that is indeed what makes him feel the worst about himself. Now, I know that people feel powerless. And oftentimes, with love addiction, the relationship becomes the higher power. And it takes over. And it becomes obsessive. And you know, I remember that I was talking to a woman who wrote a book on love addiction, and she said, you know, when I go and sit outside in the rain and watch his house to see when she leaves, I know I'm obsessed, and I know it's unhealthy. And, you know, I thought that was a great definition. You do things that you would have never done because you feel that impulsivity, that compulsivity, that desire to know, to be a part of, to be in control. And so oftentimes when I talk to my partners, you know, partners of a sex addict will say, looking at my husband's text, getting in his phone, getting on the computer, GPSing him is as addictive as I'm sure the sexual addiction itself. It makes me feel like, well, you fill in the blank. Because that behavior is so out of control to maintain a sense of control that it's crazy making. Now, you know, the bad news is when we're dealing with love addiction, people that are love addicts, I'll say women for right now, but what we know is men are love addicts too. They typically hook up with partners who are love avoidant, so they don't get their needs met. They don't get enough of each other. It feeds the compulsion. It's tough. It's very, very tough. And, you know, it can drive a woman to drive 2,000 miles in diapers to get to her partner faster. You remember that story. I do believe she was an astronaut, and she went after her partner, who was also an astronaut, who was going to be with somebody else. And she literally bought diapers, put them on, and drove the 500, 800, 1,000 miles because she didn't want to wait. She didn't want to take the time to stop at a rest area. That's how compulsive that behavior became. And so it very much feels out of control. And oftentimes it's duplicating old childhood wounds. And people think that with their new relationship, it's an opportunity to get it right the second time. But it just doesn't work like that. And that in and of itself can be really, really tough. Because what it does is it exacerbates the pain. It makes things worse. It makes people feel inadequate. And I'm here to tell you that my love addicts feel just as bad as my sex addicts. They feel just as out of control. You know, love addiction is driven by a fear of scarcity, a fear of abandonment, and a fear that they'll never get their emotional needs met. So I cannot wait to interview this marriage and family therapist who is so honest and talks about having the condition herself, and that, you know, she decided that part of getting healthy and developing the integrity one needs is to get honest. And that sex and love addiction does exist, and she cites that it affects over 8 million Americans. And then, of course, we're going to give you resources, but right now, if you have your phones ready, I want you to put in your phone the website, www.slaafws.org, because that's a fabulous place to go to find out about meetings in your area and online meetings via the telephone. And so Jessica has made it her mission to create a safe space for clients to gather resources regarding sex and love addiction. And she knows there's a lot of myths to this condition, so we're going to be talking about those myths tonight. Because sex and love addiction can be life-shattering in very unglamorous ways. It tears families apart. And as she says, it has driven some people to the edge of sanity. And I'd go so far as to say, and insanity. So we'll look forward to talking to her. And her website, in case you want more information, let me give you her email. It is jlevith@gmail.com. So, you know, she's obviously made it her mission to talk about this difficult subject and topic, and she wants to help you and let you know that there are resources around. And that's the beautiful thing about this situation, is that addiction is more and more common, and there are lots of resources. So I think you'll enjoy this interview with Jess. And so I want to say to her, Jessica, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to all of us tonight about love addiction, because, you know, sex and love addiction is kind of a new classification. So we're going to want to ask you, what do you define as sex and love addiction, and how you got so involved in this very interesting, frustrating, and also strength-building condition. So welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Hi, everybody.
Yeah. Here you are. You know, you. I put on my website that you are really going to partake in a very honest interview because you know that it takes rigorous honesty to get clean from any addiction, and you, too, had sex and love addiction. So can we talk a little bit about you and then talk a little bit about the addiction?
Sure, sure. I will definitely say that it's, you know, it's not something that you had. You know, I will probably be, it's something that you, is just a part of you, you know, just a part. And I believe it's part of who I am as a whole being now. And it's incredibly frustrating at times, as you have stated. And I have been in recovery for about 10 years. I came into recovery when I was 25, so at the time I was one of the youngest people that I knew in recovery. And it was both incredible to have language finally for what I had been going through for so many years. And it was also really scary to see the depths that people can end up in, and myself included, because of this addiction.
Well, how were you wise enough at 25 to know that you had this condition?
I don't know if I would call it wise. I was pretty desperate. I mean, I guess there is, you know, an inherent knowing that you are at your bottom, what they call bottom, in with addictions, you know, and I very much had to be, just like everyone else that comes into recovery, I had to be scraped off the ground, you know. I had no sense of self. I felt like a chameleon because I was molding myself to whatever other people wanted or what I perceived they might want, and I was always wrong. But, you know, it was, I was desperate. I was a ghost. I was walking around as a ghost, and I didn't know what to do. And so I just started Googling, you know. I don't even know if it was Googling at the time. I was just researching, what can this possibly be? Am I the only one? And I very happily realized I wasn't.
Okay, so when you Googled it, you found a definition that seemed to fit and some resources available. I mean, tell us, what were some of your, were some of the criteria that you felt you met where you could really say, hey, I'm a sex and love addict. I don't just have a problem. This
right.
is an addiction.
Right, right. So, you know, I did, you know, when you do some Googling and you read up on different sites about what is sex and love addiction, what sounded familiar for me, what resonated with me, was this idea of, you know, getting lost in the idea of someone else, like having no sense of self, and really everything that you do, everything, the way that you dress and act and talk and go get a cup of coffee, it's all to attract this fantasy of feeling whole with a partner. You know, finding that partner that's going to make you feel complete. For me, that is what resonated. There are many characteristics of sex and love addiction. Another one was losing contact with family and friends when you are in a partnership, because you are trying so desperately to make that work that everything else falls by the wayside, your job, your family, everything.
I oftentimes talk with women who are sex and love addicts, sometimes just the love addicts, sometimes sex and love addicts, and they say, I became so isolated, he became my entire world, and yet the more he became my entire world, the more I realized he couldn't meet those needs. I couldn't get enough of him to meet those needs.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is endlessly chasing that carrot that doesn't exist. You know, we're chasing a ghost. We're chasing something that I believe, you know, for a lot of cases was from childhood. It's early attachment trauma, I believe, you know, and this idea of, you know, our primary caregivers and whoever that is, whoever that was in our life, and setting down that template for us and, you know, and us trying to repair that attachment trauma through continuing to seek out partners that we think can fulfill it, but because of our primary attachments, we're just reliving the trauma over and over.
Yeah, it's like if you cannot heal those old wounds, you just keep recreating them and not being able to heal the new wounds. So you have to go mm-hmm. back and deal with the old wounds. So you mm-hmm. definitely could identify where it showed up in your own family of origin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think like many addicts, the addiction is in the family. You know, and it may be sex and love addiction, it may be food, it may be drugs, you know, but whatever it is, it created a vacancy of availability, you know, from the primary caregiver emotionally, physically, sometimes there's abuse, you know, and that is what we are trying to fill. And that's that hole that I hear a lot of times with the clients that I'm working with, you know, I feel like there's this big hole and I feel like something's missing, you know, and I believe that that's what that is.
Okay, so then when you started your support groups, because I'm assuming, did you do them in your area face-to-face or did you get on the phone and join meetings via teleconferences?
Right, I don't. I only do them face to face because I do work with this this kind of modern attachment theory model. That's where I'm based in with my practice. I really want to sit face to face with people, you know. And so it's a very small group. I've been running it for made our second year, which is awesome. And we every week we kind of get together and get current with what's happening and how this addiction is manifesting in our lives, you know, and it's just been amazing to watch the progress of the women that have come in because, you know, they're at different stages now. One is in a full-on relationship and, you know, others are struggling and it's just beautiful to watch.
Absolutely. And so you're saying that age 25 or 26, you were mm-hmm. able, you were together enough to say, okay, I'm going to start a meeting. Because really, to start any 12-step meeting, you only need two people. And so another person together and started this meeting that remains small, but where you really get mm-hmm. to watch everybody's transformation.
Oh, well, let me clear that up a little bit. So the meetings that I have weekly that I've been doing for 2 years, I actually started, I'm way over 25 now. So I came into recovery at 25. I then went back to graduate school and got my degree and, you know, have started meetings not as a 12-step, but as a therapist. So now I am now working, and it's a process group that I'm doing with these women. So that's the meeting that's been going on for 2 years. As far as, you know, other recovery group meetings, I mean, I've been going to recovery group meetings for the entire time, 10 years.
Very good. And, you know, Patrick Carnes said to me, and I truly believe this to be true, he said, you're not a good therapist. And then he stopped himself and he said, well, you're a good therapist, but you're really not providing comprehensive services unless you provide group to your specialized population. So I really can appreciate the fact that you felt the need to start this process group and you've been doing it now for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And that's where you've seen the transformations.
It's really remarkable, and it's the process group. It's so imperfect and it's so small, but it really is the heart of what my practice is. I just will not let it go. So.
So now let's go into, just in case someone's just tuning into the show, and say your last name for me. Is it Levis?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm talking with Jessica Levis, and she is a marriage and family therapist who specifically works with the population of sex and love addicts, and she's open and honest enough to say she, too, is recovering from this addiction, and so you have a special place in your heart for this. Now, go over the criteria or the definition of what you believe love addiction is.
Okay. I see sex and love addiction as very, very often intertwined, and I would give the definition of sex and love addiction as someone who develops a progressive compulsion to engage or avoid emotional attachment, sex, or love, and I think that it's a complex mixture of features from both sex addiction and love addiction, and, everybody that comes in for recovery is going to present differently, and those patterns are driven by their personal physiology and their psychological history. So one person may be coming in as a love avoidant, who was from a very, very detached family. And another person may come in as a love addict and / sex addict who is using their body as a means of currency, because maybe that somewhere along the lines, unfortunately, they learned that was how you get love. So, yeah.
And do you follow a particular model? Because obviously Pia Melody has done a lot of work around love addiction. Ann Wilson Shape has done a lot of work around sex and love addiction. Is there anybody's books or model you feel is specifically helpful for yourself and for your clients?
Right. I mean, I love Pia Melody, and I, of course, so admire Patrick Carnes. And so any one of their books, I think Codependency from Pia Melody, as well as the Facing Love Addiction, and then also with Patrick Carnes, he's very good at setting up structure for how to really go into the roots of what's happening with sex addiction. So Facing the Shadow with Patrick Carnes, that's a great book. But then I read a lot because I come from this modern attachment theory of, the neurobiology of early attachment and the neuropsychology of early attachment. I read a lot of Dr. Alan Shore. It's a little bit harder of a read, but it's also... it really goes into primary caregiver and how it sets down this physiological template in our body to respond to future relationships.
Okay, well, I know Alan Shore is a researcher, and he studies the brain, does he not?
He does, yes. I'm really lucky enough to be in a study group of his that's about 4 times a year, and the research is overwhelming, and it's constantly shifting and changing, but it's getting more and more exciting for people who, or more hopeful for people who are addicts, that you can, in fact, change your behavior.
Okay, so then, obviously, before you came on the show, I said that most love addicts and sex and love addicts, or love avoidance have big T or little T traumas. Can you describe some of those and what you found that many of your clients deal with?
Sure. So the little T traumas, you know, it almost seems unfair to call them little T's because they can be so profound. But I would say that most of my clients that come in have that developmental trauma, you know, more of the pervasive, just, you know, building, their life is built on the unavailability of the parent or the unavailability of the partner, or they have been, you know, sexually abused or exploited and then have learned that behavior unfortunately gets them attention. So then they turn around and exploit, you know, not by any fault of their own, that just because they had learned that, they're starting to exploit themselves to get that love and that continue or perceived love. And so by the time they come into my office, they have had a lifetime of these really unhealthy behaviors that are based on, you know, so many, as with any addiction, so many potential causes, you know. Hold on one second. Let me just, I had a few of them written down here. I mean, it's just like genetic predisposition, modeling behavior from the parents if they were addicts, over-parentification, so like if a parent is switching roles with you and you have to parent them, mental illness in the family, overt, covert sexual abuse or incest, you know, and then you have, you know, severe emotional neglect. That's huge. That's huge, and it's really under valued as a cause.
And you said overt and covert. Can you explain to our listening audience what you mean there?
Sure. Overt sexual abuse and incest, that is blatant. Someone is inappropriately touching you. You know, and this could be a family member, this could be a family friend. At any age, it's, you know, it's someone who is really violating your physical boundary. And covert, you know, I absolutely think this is just as powerful of a trauma. It's the subtlety. It's the, my parents walk around nude, or they have sex with the door open, or, you know, there is just such poor boundary with the adult and the child, or whoever the abuser is, the perpetrator. And so you start questioning yourself. Did this really happen? Is this really abuse? I'm not sure it's abuse, but it feels really yucky, you know, and it can be maddening. And I've definitely seen that in my practice.
Those were great descriptions of what covert and overt is, because certainly, you know, if parents don't have a good sense of boundaries, it really is confusing to the child. And then the child
Absolutely.
Starts questioning their own sense of reality. And this can happen oftentimes when a sex and love addiction is occurring. So I'm glad you clarified that. Now, you said there are some myths associated with love and sex addiction. So can we talk about those for a second?
Sure. Well, so the first one is that, you know, sex and love addiction is real. The myth is that it's not. The myth is that, you know, it's, you know, pop psychology and, you know, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps and stop dating that person. You know, they're abusive. Stop dating them. And, you know, to ask any sex and love addict if it's real. You know, it's incredibly invalidating to the experience of the people who have it. So, I mean, that's the first myth. And you know, also there's this myth of the sex and love addict character, right? So, like, it's really the way it's portrayed in movies and in books, and in, you know, the media, billboards, everything. It's, you know, these these pendulum swings of the pervs or the studs, you know. So you've got the pervs that are in hiding out in the bushes, you know, waiting to flash you. And then you've got the, you know, the studs who are these rock stars or super sexy women, and, you know, they can't get enough. And these are this is the vision of sex and love addiction. And it's, I'm not saying those two extremes don't exist. They absolutely do. But there are millions of people in between in the gray area, you know, and for that, you're minimizing their experience because they're, you know, housewives, and they're firefighters, and they're people who bag your groceries.
That's a wonderful explanation of the fact that this affliction can occur in anybody, again, in part because of serious childhood trauma, whether it be overt or covert, it can affect and be devastating. Now, obviously shared some myths, and I'm curious as to what kinds of questions did you have about yourself as you were flirting with the fact that, you know, boy, this doesn't seem like healthy behavior, and at the same time, you still were unsure. You hadn't Googled yet. You hadn't done your research.
Right. Oh, boy, that's a good question. Well, there's this interesting example that I give sometimes of I met a gentleman at a coffee shop and gave him my number. And within 3 hours, I was wondering why this person wasn't calling me. Had I given him the wrong number? You know, why wouldn't he call? I mean, of course he would call. No, he hasn't called. And so by the next day, I am in fetal position on the floor in between my sink and my stove trying to figure, like, sweating, nauseous, having these weird, visceral, intense reactions to a man I have never met. I met him for 20 minutes, you know, and this is what was like, this was in my mind, like, this is not okay, you know, I feel like I'm going to die. And so that was not the first time that's happened, you know, that had been happening for years over many different people, and it just felt like what was happening in the moment wasn't matching up to what I was feeling. You know what I'm saying? Like, what was presented to me just meeting this man, that wasn't matching up with my affect and what I was experiencing, and it felt very wrong and disconnected. So I knew that something was going on.
You know, that is a good example because, again, it feels like very crazy behavior. And at the same time, there's a part of it that feels very, very normal, especially because you probably had a whole history of experiencing men this way, you know, going out with them and fantasizing about, wow, I wonder if we're going to get married. I wonder what they'd like me to wear. I wonder, you know, why they haven't called. It's part of the illusion of their interest, when that doesn't occur immediately, you start assuming there's something wrong.
Yep.
So then, breaking point for you. When did you decide, okay, I need some help?
I think I'm laughing because anyone that has reached the bottom in sex and love addiction just knows that it's a moment where you find yourself almost having an out-of-body experience and looking at yourself and going, am I really doing this? You know, like, nothing was enough. Like, no amount of boyfriends, no compliment, no... it was this culmination, you know, around my 25th birthday when I went into recovery, you know, and it was being at this birthday party for myself where I'm surrounded by men and nothing was enough. You know, they all were there. There was not one girl at the party. But, you know, and I kind of stood outside of myself and looked at it and said, wow, like, this is ridiculous. You know, how is this not enough? I'm either going to go crazy or I'm not going to make it, you know? And I just knew that I had to find something else, a different way.
Well, you know, that can lead to not only emotional pain, but physical pain. I mean, it can feel like there's withdrawals, and there can feel like, you know, you've got so many ruminating thoughts that you can't calm yourself down. And that's oftentimes when my sex and love addicts have experienced enough physical pain along with the emotional, they, as you said early on in the show, they kind of hit a rock bottom and they go, I cannot live like this. And obviously this, as well as any other addiction, isn't cured, that you learn how to manage it. So what was your treatment? I mean, what did you do to manage this disease?
I went into individual therapy for a very long time and multiple times a week. And many people are saying, well, that's very expensive. And I went to a sliding scale clinic. And at one point I was paying $5 a session. But what I had to do was retrain my brain of how I thought about things, my inner narrative, how I saw the world, how I saw myself. I had to build myself from scratch, you know. I also joined recovery groups and went multiple times a week. I mean, there were years that I was doing practically nothing except recovery stuff, you know, and I didn't really feel like, if I wanted to get better, I didn't feel like I had a choice. I felt like I had to do this, you know, because I had spent so many years acting out and kind of creating this addict, you know, that I knew it was going to take not just as long, but, you know, a long time for me to kind of slowly unwind everything and pick it apart and recover.
Totally makes sense to me. And, you know, you obviously, when you hit your rock bottom, you wanted to get healthy and you would do anything to do that, because I heard you say you even went twice a week.
Oh, I went to therapy. There were times I went to therapy 3 or 4 times a week. And then there, I mean, it wasn't psychoanalysis, but it, you know, it was, I went almost as much. And then, you know, in addition to that, I would go to meetings. Obviously, not everybody can do this. And you do what you can and you go as slow as you need to go. But I do highly, highly recommend that if you are, if you're looking for recovery, to get a therapist and to get someone, if possible, who really knows about this addiction. You know, if you've got someone who's got the CSAT, which is that certification from Patrick Carnes, that's amazing. If there's no one in your area that does, you know, just go for someone that works with early attachment or relational or relationships, you know, but preferably someone that knows about sex and love addiction.
Absolutely. And that's a good point. Everybody does it differently. But I'm a believer in, when you've hit rock bottom, the more intensive treatment you get, the more you're going to get out of it. So you do as much as you can and you don't poo-poo it or let a lot of other things come first, because you got to hit while the iron's, you know, hot. And so you can appreciate the fact that, yeah, you went for a sliding fee scale. It wasn't like you were seeing somebody at $150 an hour twice a week.
No, I was. I mean, I was a 25-year-old barista at the time. You know, I didn't have that kind of money, and I wasn't getting help from my family. And it, you know, it's just, you can feel very, very isolated to begin with this issue. You know, I do agree with you. I think that you, if you are coming into recovery for this, you have to have a certain amount of drive and give recovery the same attention that you were given your addiction or your qualifier.
Well, I 100% agree with that. Now, do you think that you justified the behaviors of a sex and love addict?
When I was actively acting out. I think that sometimes, because I go around and I give lectures, many lectures on this, just to really advocate for this issue and to build awareness around it, that it's a real thing. And I think that sometimes people can get the impression that I'm justifying the actions of the sex addict or the person that has harmed them, you know, because a lot of people have been very, very hurt by sex and love addicts and by their behaviors. I mean, we're talking about prostitution. We're talking about online pornography. We're talking about, you know, child endangerment. And how could I possibly try to justify their behaviors? And I tell people that I don't justify it. I'm trying to explain it. And there's a difference. Because the longer that we don't talk about it and we don't try to figure out what is at the root of this or the source of this, the longer it's going to be swept under the rug. And so I want to be very clear that, you know, yes, I was a sex and love addict, and I was a partner as well of a sex and love addict, because water seeks its own level. And I dated a bunch of sex and love addicts, you know, but I think it's really important to know that I am never justifying some of the really egregious behaviors that can come out of sex and love addiction. I'm just trying to provide some context and an explanation, potential explanation for behaviors.
That totally makes sense. Now, I kind of alluded to the fact that obviously when you're a sex and love addict, you need to maintain recovery. So do you believe anybody can ever recover from sex and love addiction?
That's a really hard question. I think that anything is possible in this world. I have not seen a, quote, recovered sex and love addict. I think that you need to learn an entire new relationship to your own sexuality and to your attachment style. You know, you have to completely relearn a healthy way of relating to others. And it becomes part of who you are. Your sex and love addiction, in my experience, I'm pretty sure I'll have it forever. You know, these pangs of, what if, you know, what if I dropped everything now and went back into my addiction and went and go and looked up that one guy, you know, and it gets to the point when you've had enough recovery that you can almost chuckle at yourself, because you'll realize, you know, that it's the addict thinking and talking in your brain. I think it's dangerous to say that you're, quote, recovered, because I think that that's when this insidious addiction can kind of creep in.
Yeah, good point. Now, how would you suggest that our listeners who may be wondering if they have a sex and love addiction, how might they get some treatment or some help? Or I'm sure there's a test to take on the SLA website, is there not?
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily a test, but it is the characteristics. I've got one on my website, which, by the way, it's actually jesslevisma@gmail.com. That's my personal, business email. But also on my website, eastbaysexandloveaddiction.com, I've got it just right there for you, the 12 characteristics of sex and love addiction. I think that, you know, if you Google any sex and love addiction therapist, usually on their website, they will have, you know, the standard questions that you ask, you know, the SOAA website itself is amazing. It's got so many different pamphlets that you can check over and see what kind, how it may be presenting with you. Are you an anorexic, meaning you avoid the pleasure of relationships and or sex, you know? Yeah, there's so many different ways that you can kind of just gauge yourself. But I would always say that when you're taking these quizzes or tests, wherever they are, you know, please take it with a grain of salt. And then it's information for you to have, but go to a therapist, you know, and really check in with somebody, because these tests can trigger you, and meaning they can really jolt you emotionally.
Okay, so let's go over that information again. If you want to contact Jess and ask her about more information, find out, you know, you work out of Oakland, California.
Yes.
So anybody who's in the Oakland, California area, you can contact Jess. Or if there's other people out there that have a question for her, you can reach her at Jess, J-E-S-S, Levis, L-E-V-I-T-H-M-A, at gmail.com. And again, your website, Jess, is?
East Bay, so E-A-S-T, Bay, B-A-Y, sexandloveaddiction.com.
So it's there that you can actually look at the criteria and see how many you meet. Or, as she indicated earlier, that going to the website, and I'm not exactly sure what all those initials stand for, but I do know that it's www.slaafws.org. And it's there that you can find all sorts of information on sex addiction, sex and love addiction, sex and emotional anorexia, codependency. There's all sorts of information that will help to kind of break out what things might be that you may be suffering from. Now, you said that sex and love addiction affects 8 million Americans. And that, you know, I have never seen Californication, but certainly that show, as far as you are concerned, kind of glorifies sex and love addicts, and yet also puts them down.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of superstar slash shame device. And the 8 million figure comes from actually Patrick Carn, who, if you go to his website, you know, lists all the basic facts, and that's just sex addiction. And the 8 million is also referring to people who are self-identified, who even know that this exists and have identified themselves, you know, like, so it's, I'm guessing if you're adding love addiction to the sex and love addiction, it's way higher.
Absolutely. You know, as a clinician, and I am one too, I run a Monday night men's group as well as a large part of my practice. I was appalled and yet kind of understood that truly all of these types of addiction are so new in terms of being recognized by the AMA and the American Psychological Association, but they have not created diagnoses for them. As a matter of fact, we're still trying to tease that out and explain to the AMA and the APA why we believe that it absolutely is an addiction. And that has to do with the compulsivity. What do you think? Do you think that sex and love addiction will be recognized in the future as a full-fledged addiction?
Well, that's really interesting. I think for people who work in this field and for sex addicts, you know, and sex and love addicts, it's painful to be invalidated like that. you know, to not have the diagnoses, even though, you know, a diagnosis is a double-edged sword, because then you can also try to unconsciously live up to all of the symptoms. But I think that, yes, I think in time this will be validated by all of these agencies, but it may not have the name that we're looking for. So, you know, so hypersexuality, for example, was denied in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is for 2000, what was it? It's the fifth edition. So, you know, basically,
edition.
Yeah, it was denied. And I, my gut feeling, at least it's because it's the where I come from with this, with the attachment theory, is the more we can reduce the shame around this addiction, the sooner people will start recognizing it, you know, because I think it's the shame that causes people to kind of make fun of it or deny it. But I think the more we can really connect it to attachment and relationships, and these very normal human desires, I think the sooner it will be taken more seriously. Because, I mean, people that come in now, yes, I'm having to give them a diagnosis of chronic anxiety or depression, but what's really happening? Why are you anxious? Why are you depressed? Oh, because you can't get into a healthy relationship. Okay. You know, so it's masking. I believe the anxiety and the depression are the symptoms of this underlying issue.
Well, I do too. And, you know, the other thing I believe, and we are working so diligently on this, and I'm soon to have them on, is I've got AFAR coming on. And, of course, mm-hmm. that is the research organization that substantiates sex addiction, love addiction, mm-hmm. and we need more research to substantiate mm-hmm. that this is truly a condition, and we're in the process of that. I foresee that the next time this manual is revised,
mm-hmm.
there will be something, and I agree with you. We don't have to call it sexual addiction. Let's call it hypersexuality. But there will be something to identify that this is a real-life problem that requires more than willpower, you know, which mm-hmm. is what so many people used to say about alcoholics. Oh, just pick mm-hmm. yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, have mm-hmm. some willpower, determination, some self-discipline, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Appreciate you helping us. Again, you were recommended by one of my listeners who had heard you talk, and so I contacted you, and you said, where'd you get my name? But I knew that you had a story to tell, and it's obvious that you have a real passion for a population that's underserved, and anybody would be lucky to have you as their therapist. And I'm talking to Jessica Levitt, and her actual email, because I gave you the wrong one the first time, I gave you the one that I had, is jessleviththma@gmail.com. And her website is eastbaysexandloveaddiction.com. So, Jess, thank you so much for helping out tonight and educating our listeners about sex and love addiction.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right, you take care, and we'll talk soon. When you write that book, let me know.
All right, take care.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so as you can see, she's got a lot of great information about sex and love addiction. Go to her website, take a look at it, and, you know, that's what this show's all about. I am so happy to be with you. And every Monday night, we interview the experts in the field. And as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times. So fearlessly, have the courage to be yourself. Enjoy some spring weather wherever you're at. And I'll catch you next Monday night for Sex Help with Carol, the coach.